You know, so much of what we discover on this amazing adventure that we're sharing, the adventure of our retreat and the adventure of our lifelong pilgrimage, is not about making more effort. It's not about working harder. It's about focusing differently often. It's about revaluing what you value, but it's also very much about surrender. It's about surrendering some of the habits of mind that don't serve you well. And one of the great things about meditation is that your habits of mind become very obvious to you, how boring most of them are, how restrictive. And the other thing that meditation teaches you, and also your times of reflection and contemplation and prayer teach you, is that a lot of it is about surrendering, even surrendering your defenses. A lot of the bad habits of mind that we have are really just defenses. And what are they defenses against? They're defenses against our anxiety. We attempt to worry our way into being well. In fact, there's a rather disparaging term that's used for people who worked, as I did, in private practice and therapy for a long time, that we worked with a worried well. It was a little bit disparaging, as though those concerns were not of such merit. But in fact, it's very disparaging, because if we are well enough to worry about how we're worrying, we can also make a difference. We can make a difference. But it isn't skillful just to worry our way into our worries and worry more and more and more about our worries. We can actually learn to be far more subtle and far more skillful. And that's what this beautiful Native American teaching is telling us. We can be lost in our thoughts and fears. We can be lost as we would in the midst of a forest where it's so overgrown we can't find a pathway out. That's what happens at 3 a.m. And that's what happens with our repetitive, obsessive thinking. Or, says the teaching, we can remember to breathe, to soften the heart, and to trust. And that is what surrender is. Surrender is a softening of the heart, to trust. Not only to trust that we can afford to soften the heart, but also to trust that we can survive it when people hurt our heart, when people disappoint us, when people let us down, and sometimes those people will be ourselves. That's what the trust is. It's not a trust that everything will be all right, that from now on, you know, I can absolutely guarantee that everything will be hunky-dory. It won't. But what you can trust is that you can find the courage, that you can find the consolation, that you can find the strengths you need, living from this place that for this very moment we're calling a sanctuary of love. It could also be called the generator of love. But it is a sanctuary. It is a place of refuge. It is a place of, you know, that lovely phrase, pulling ourselves together. We're often told to pull ourselves together, in a disparaging way. But actually, when we put ourselves back together, this can be an act of great healing and of great love, to put ourselves together so that the pieces of ourselves are not thrown to the four winds, that we bring ourselves back together in this place called the sanctuary of love. So the teaching goes on, sometimes I go about pitying myself, feeling unsure, and all the while I am being carried by great winds across the sky. Isn't that a beautiful teaching? I'll read the whole of it now and make no comment. We can be lost in our thoughts and fears, Or we can remember to breathe, to soften the heart, to trust. Sometimes I go about pitying myself, feeling unsure, and all the while I am being carried by great winds across the sky. You know, one of the marvels of being an interfaith teacher is that I have these treasures that come from all the directions. So I can't help in reading this from the American Indians to be reminded of another Indian, an Indian called Rabindranath Tagore, who says, "The winds of God's grace are always blowing. It is up to us to raise the sails." And don't you see in that the intense cooperation that is also a quality that is being called for here? That we are given these teachings, but our job, our part, is not just to receive them, it is to cooperate with them. I can't cooperate for you. That's where your will comes in. That's where your beauty comes in. That's where your vigor comes in. That's where your strength of mind comes in. That's where your courage comes in. I can't give you that. All I can do is call in the qualities that we all need. Yeah. And you can light the fire. And I believe you must light the fire. And that the more of us who light the fire with and alongside one another, the more natural this naturalness will appear to be. And here from another ancient time, from the Chandogya Upanishad, there is a light that shines beyond all things on earth, beyond the highest, oh, the very highest heavens. This is the light that shines in your heart. Could you trust it? I mean, if we took at least one of these teachings one bit seriously, the hairs on the backs of our neck would stand on end and never lie down again, and we would be enlightened. We're so inclined to think, "It's probably for that other person who's been here a lot of times, here in this life, here at Mana. Could it possibly be for me?" You know, the Buddhists give us a lot, and just very quickly I'm going to give a tiny glimpse of what I intended to give hours to today. But how lovely to be a little bit flexible with what I felt was needed. I wanted to really focus on compassionate living, because there's really little point in discovering and rediscovering and familiarizing ourselves with the sanctuary of love unless it leads us in practical ways to more compassionate living. And I've given you many, many hints already, and you have many hints, you know many hints. You are thoroughly resourced already from the experiences of your own life as to what feels good and what doesn't, and what feels wholesome and what feels healing and what does not. That is your great teacher. That is your great teaching. And again, I want to remind you that your body is the barometer in this. What makes you freeze? What makes you contract? What makes you expand? What makes you sing? What makes your heart sing? What makes your voice sing? Do more of it. What delights the people that you claim to love? Do more of it. Look into their eyes. and you will see what you need to do more of, and do more of it. However, the Buddhists have teachings for every possible situation. And they serve our inclusive spiritual path very, very well. And they have what they call six paramitas. And paramita means, it's such an interesting Sanskrit word. It means going to the other shore. Now, in truth, there is no other shore. There is only the shore. And I'm very interested in this metaphor. The very first novel that I wrote, and the very first serious book that I wrote after I decided to move from publishing to writing, was a novel called Running Backwards Over Sand. Now, we know that sand is right next to the ocean. We know that running backwards has its difficulties, but that sometimes we really need to, though whether we need to do it at a fast pace is, of course, another question. Running backwards over sand, so that the sand is the place where we can most closely and clearly observe the tides, the going out and the coming in. And as we grow in spiritual awareness and spiritual wisdom, we become more and more aware of the tides, don't we? It's the same ocean. It goes out and it comes in. Yeah? Still thinking about the shore? The ocean that goes out and comes in. And then a few years later, I wrote another novel called Tasting Salt. And that title came from a Buddhist teaching, which is that all the oceans of our universe have one but one taste, and that is the taste of salt. And all the great teachings have but one taste, and that is the taste of freedom. Everything that I'm bringing you is about freedom. It's about freeing you and me and all of us to make choices that are of benefit to us rather than making choices that inhibit us as we pilgrim our way through this wondrous life. Yeah. It's all about liberation. It's all about you knowing that you can choose. Before I even get to the paramitas, I want to just say this from the Tao. Those who are good, I treat as good. Those who are good, I treat as good. It's from the Tao Te Ching. Those who are not good, I treat as good. In this, I discover goodness. I have written so much about this freedom in all of my books, but maybe very particularly in Choosing Happiness, in the Universal Heart, and in Seeking the Sacred. We need to discover our freedom. I can't give it to you. I can invite you to invite it into your own heart and mind. You see, we imagine that we are the product of our stories, not just our experiences. We imagine that we are the product. I might never get to the paramitas. It's nearly lunchtime. They might really be on the other shore. We often imagine that in thinking about these things we will be restricted, but the opposite is true. We will be freed. We will be liberated, especially from the delusion that we are the product of our stories. My mother did this, your father did that, I did that. Of course that's affected us. Of course that has affected us in the same way that we are profoundly and deeply marked by the things that are happening to us this very day, by the things that are about to happen. Of course we are shaped and marked, but we are more than the product of our stories. This is what Viktor Frankl discovered when he wrote, not when he wrote, but when he lived the terror of the concentration camps in the Second World War. What he discovered is that we are more than the product of our stories, and that we are more than the outcome of other people's choices and behavior. We are more. We, in every situation, and sometimes with the greatest difficulty, sometimes it will be like finding a grain of rice in the dark to discover that grain of freedom that we still have, which does not mean that we discover that we don't have to mourn, that we don't have to weep, that we don't have to gnash our teeth. Of course we will do those things. But the tide that goes far, far out will also come in again. I'm determined to give you one parameter. First I'll tell you what they are, because there's six of them. And we may or may not get to them. You might have to get to them at another time. The first of them is generosity, and particularly the generosity of letting go of unhelpful habits. How could we be more generous to ourselves in letting go of unhelpful habits? I dedicate this to all of you. How can we be more generous? And even, how can we be more mindful of time? What are we postponing? How long do you think you've got in this lifetime? How long do you think you've got? Worth thinking about. You know, and in acting generously, we can really hold that teaching from the Tao in mind. We are not dependent upon a reward for our generosity. If we are dependent on a reward for our generosity, or other people praising us for it, or noticing and giving us a gold star, then we are not truly generous. In fact, if generosity is something that really speaks to you or sings to you or invites you, I urge you to practice as much generosity in the way that the Brahmakumaris talk about it, incognito, as possible, so that there's all the rewards are intrinsic. All the rewards are to discover what freedom is, that you can afford to be generous, and that miserliness shrinks your heart. Miserliness of spirit shrinks the heart. And yes, sometimes people will take advantage of it, and so what? I mean, you will still be careful, and you will still have your careful boundaries, and you will not go where the snake can bite you twice, unless you like snake bites. But you can afford to be generous, particularly to yourself in times of trouble. In times of trouble, let it be, let it be. Mm-hmm. Let it be, let it be. Let it be, let it be. Mm-hmm. In other words, no beating yourself up. Beating yourself up is an act of great ungenerosity. All right, the second one is discipline, which really means, I will give you some thoughts about this tomorrow, but it really means commitment. In my book, it means commitment. It means giving yourself the boundaries, the rhythms. Those of us who've been at all influenced by anthroposophy, Rudolf Steiner's teachings, which are profound, know that we gain freedom from the discipline of rhythms and routines. One example, do you ask yourself every morning, do I feel like getting towards my cushion or my chair to meditate? Do you ask yourself every morning, do I feel like having breakfast? Do I feel like cleaning my teeth? Do I feel like tying my shoelaces? In other words, you don't need to be driven by your feelings. There are some things that you make a commitment to. In that paramita also comes your ethics, that you are choosing above everything actions and choices and behaviors that will do no harm. The third paramita is the absolutely delicious patience. Oh. Patience is the prelude to mindfulness, and it is utterly, utterly counterintuitive in the 21st century. And why is it counterintuitive? Because a little part of us, a little part of all of us, feels entitled always to get the last parking spot, always to find ourselves at the front of the queue, always to find ourselves included rather than excluded, pretty often to find our own stories just a tad more interesting than other people. Patience is a very timeless quality that really does take us to the other shore. In this way, it gives us another view of what matters. Patience lets us know what matters, and it's not always our needs first. When we are impatient, actually what we are unreconciled to is that we're sharing this world with a lot of people and that an extraordinary number of them are very irritating. You know, that's what we're expressing, isn't it? Impatience. Or that someone else's rhythm and routine and timing will be different from ours. Impatience. Patience. Patience. It's not about passivity. It takes great presence of mind, as I know to my sorrow. It takes great presence of mind to learn to be patient, even around how you do something as opposed to how somebody else would do something, to let them do it in their way. Takes a lot of patience. The fourth of them is joyful effort. We've talked a little bit about that already. We've talked about the surrender so that the effort becomes effortless. And every morning when I'm giving you your guidance about meditation, and you're most welcome to bring your phones and record the guided part of the meditation, because really what I'm wanting to teach you is that effort doesn't bring us into intimate contact with our meditator's mind. We don't try to meditate. We allow meditation. Do you feel that difference? We don't try to meditate. We don't try to commit. We commit. And we allow meditation to be our teacher. And we don't either say to ourselves, oh, that was awfully boring, I won't do it tomorrow. We commit. In the same way, when we commit to a loved one, we expect them to put up with our very boring moments. So the least we can do is return the favor. We commit. The other person doesn't have to be fascinating at every single moment. How exhausting that would be. Five is meditation. The fifth parameter is meditation, which actually means consciousness. It also means, in my book, conscience. Letting yourself know what is working and what is not working. Those two words sit very well together for me. Conscience and consciousness. And the sixth one is unconditional wisdom, which really means the truth will set you free. Seeing things as they are and responding to them generously. So there's a beautiful circle there, because with unconditional wisdom comes generosity, and with generosity comes wisdom. And the circle is really completed when we understand that in all of this, there is the everlasting dance of yin and yang. There is the everlasting dance of reflection and action, of self and other, of I and you, of we and they, of us and the allness of the all, the many in the one and the one in the many, but particularly of the yin as we reflect on our actions, and the yang as we act as reflective beings. Om Shanti.